The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
Welcome. If you're a fan of distilled spirits, we have got the podcast for you today because Jeff Arnett, who is the master distiller at Jack Daniel's in Lynchburg, Tennessee, is our special guest on the podcast. He's actually in studio with us, and he's going to be with us in just a second here. And I'm gonna, you know, first of all, the reason I'm having him on is I'm hoping for a free sample. Obviously, no, actually, you know, a lot of people make pilgrimages out to Tennessee, Lynchburg, to go through the Jack Daniel's distillery. It's actually a very huge tourist attraction, and actually they're doing something kind of cool in Tennessee. Is there's so many new distilleries that's opening up. They're starting something called the Tennessee Whiskey Trail with the Tennessee Department of Tourism, not unsimilar to what they have in Kentucky with their Bourbon Trail. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. But I also have, I have a few questions also, like, what is the difference between bourbon and Tennessee whiskey? And, you know, is there really a certain classification? So we will talk to Jeff Arnett shortly. And also Simone Biles, the Olympic gymnast, the gold medalist, four-time gold medalist at the Rio Games. We'll be talking to her. She's got a new book called Courage to Soar. And one thing I've always wanted to know about any Olympic athlete is when, and I love the Olympics. If you listen to the podcast, you know from the very first episode how I love the Olympics. But if you're an Olympic athlete, how much time do you have to enjoy, A, the country of Brazil or wherever you're at that particular moment, and how much time do you have to enjoy other events, especially if you're someone of the stature of Simone Biles, who was in the team all-around event, then she was in the individual all-around event, and then she was on, competed in different apparatus. And so if you add all that up, that's like five or six different events. She I think it's five events because she won five medals. There were four golds and a bronze. So, you know, I just wonder how much time she has to actually enjoy the Olympics. And then there's also, you add on to that, the stature of someone at the Olympics, of Simone Biles. So if you follow the Olympics, you know that she probably was one of those prominent athletes that walked away from the games with four gold medals. She really redefined the sport of gymnastics at the Rio Games. So how much time will she, you know, how much was she able to enjoy that? And we'll talk to her shortly also on the podcast. Before we get to Jeff Arnett, the master distiller, I want to share a story with you about, I'm going to be honest, I'm not a big drinker. I enjoy a drink every now and then. And if someone makes something special, or if there's, you know, a special type of whiskey, sure, I'll sample and stuff. But I'm not, you know, drinking just makes me tired. So, you know, I get up at 3:30 in the morning to do a morning radio show. That's the last thing I want to do, is feel more tired. But the story has a point here. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Cuba as a goodwill mission. It was sponsored by, we were permitted to go by the State Department of the U.S. I have the paperwork, by the way, still, if you want to see it. That's directed to the State Department, by the way. So we went as a baseball team of American baseball players. It was like I said, it was a goodwill team. And we played different teams from throughout Cuba. We were in Cienfuegos, we were in Havana, we were in just a whole bunch of different cities. We played everybody from the Legends of the Cuban League, which were guys that were like in their 40s that one time were stars in Cuba, to we played a steel mill. They had their own town team. We played an up-and-coming junior team, and we got to meet a lot of people, had a great time. Well, one of the things in Cuba that's very popular is a drink is the mojito, of course, made of rum. But another drink is very popular that a lot of people know about is aged rum. It's seven-year-old rum. And you don't drink it in mixed drinks. Like, you wouldn't put it in Coke. You drink it. It's almost like a brandy. You drink it like in a glass, a small glass. You don't put ice on it. You just drink it like you would drink straight whiskey. And I never had this before. I never even really knew that there was aged rum that you would drink that way. I'd have only known rum like something you would drink in a rum and Coke. And it's really good, and I really enjoyed it. It's probably one of my favorite drinks, and you really have to look for it in the U.S. If you go to a liquor store, aged rum, they maybe only have one or two bottles of it. In Cuba, though, it's everywhere. And one of the brands in Cuba is Havana Club. Until recently, you could not get Havana Club in the U.S. There's kind of a dispute to the brand Havana Club. But at the time when I was there, Havana Club was a brand that was only available. It was a Cuban-made product only available in Cuba And any country that had relations with Cuba. Well, the U.S. did not have relations with Cuba, but Mexico did. So if you're in Mexico, you might be able to find a bottle of a 7-year-old or 8-year-old aged rum from the brand Havana Club. So a few years ago, my wife and I were in Mexico. We went to a resort on Playa del Carmen, and we went to a pretty nice resort. It was an all-inclusive resort, and we splurged, and we, you know, we've been to a few all-inclusive resorts, but we really splurged on this one. And one of the things that they had at this all-inclusive resort, in the evening, they had a bar. Now, it's all-inclusive, so the bar is totally free, and this was a high-end bar. And in the bar, they had a bottle. I saw it there. It was, like, prominently displayed of Havana Club aged rum, 7-year-old rum. And I told my wife, I go, that's the drink that I had when I was in Cuba, and I'm going to get a glass of that and enjoy some of that. Well, I don't think I think their point of displaying it was, hey, we got the bottle here, but not very many people ever asked for it because they didn't know what it was. So I asked for a glass of it, and then later in the evening, I asked a second glass of it. The next day, that bottle was gone. It was not on display anymore. They took it out of the bar because nobody ever ordered it. It's an expensive bottle to get. It's pretty treasured rum, and it's a pretty treasured drink. So I thought it was kind of funny that the all-inclusive resort, they were very proud to display that they had Havana Club rum. But when you asked for a drink of it, they were really not too, they didn't really want to share that much of it, and it was disappeared. So that's a little story, roundabout way to tell you what I know about drinking. Because, like, I don't really know a lot, but that's one of the reasons I asked Jeff Arnett here. Jeff is the master distiller at Jack Daniel's, Lynchburg, Tennessee. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but there have not been many people that have held that title of master distiller.
That is correct. We're actually celebrating our 151st year as a company. So if you go back to the 1860s, there have been 28 presidents and 12 popes, but I am only the 7th master distiller in the history of our company. So it's a very, very short list. And I often tell people that makes my job 4 times better than being the president and almost twice as good as being the pope. And that's just doing math on those numbers. But yeah, I became the 7th master distiller after working at the distillery for only 7 years. Mm-hmm. Of course, our famous brand is Old Number 7.
Yeah.
And we don't know why Jack called the brand that. You know, whether it was a recipe number or a lucky number, I often tell people that's got to be the luckiest number in the world, because you can't hear my story of being the 7th master distiller for Old Number 7. And, you know, for a lot of companies, 7 years, that's a long tenure.
Yeah.
But at Jack Daniel's, you're still very wet behind the ears. Most of the people that I work with, you know, have learned how to make whiskey from their parents and grandparents. Mm-hmm. Many of them have 25 or 30 years of experience. Uh-huh. So I've got 16 years at Jack Daniel's now, but that makes me closer to average than it does, you know, being senior.
Well, now, obviously, the reason I have you on is because a lot of people, it's a tourist attraction. People go there and they make a pilgrimage to Tennessee to go to the distillery.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a native Tennessean, but I spent some time outside the state, and I lived in several different states. But whenever I would tell somebody that I was from the state of Tennessee, the things that would come up, you know, would be Elvis, country music, and of course, Jack Daniel's.
Uh-huh.
I think we're clearly one of the most popular things that gets exported out of the state. And I'm proud to be a part of, you know, a brand that's kind of world known and loved, that kind of represents the state of Tennessee as well as it does.
Now, where is the distillery located? And is there something of note about this area that it's located? Because I've heard this story too.
It is, you know, the closest point of entry to get to Lynchburg would be Nashville. Okay. We're about 75 miles south of Nashville. We're in Moore County, which is the second smallest county of the 95 that make up the state of Tennessee, both by geography and population. So it's a pretty small area. And I think the thing that's, you know, probably most notable about Moore County is that even though we make every drop of Jack Daniel's there because it's our only distillery, it is considered to be a dry county.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no bars or restaurants there that have liquor by the drink. So you can't go downtown on our square and order a drink of Jack Daniel's. But they have loosened up the laws a little bit. We are allowed to have a collectible bottle shop that people can kind of take souvenir bottles home from the tour. And they're also allowing us now to do a sampling tour. So we can do 5 small samples of different products that we make and strictly really for educational purposes.
Oh, sure, educational purposes. You're not seeing the same people from the town coming in every day to educate themselves on the samples, are you?
No, but it is. I think it's pretty helpful, because when we had a bottle shop and didn't do sampling tours, people would kind of walk around inside the bottle shop and they would see different versions of Jack Daniel's. Uh-huh. And they didn't really know which would be their favorite.
Uh-huh.
But now they come off these tasting tours and they're very clear. You know, it's still, the taste of it's still on their lips. So they kind of walk straight to the section of the store that has the bottle that was their favorite from the tasting, and they're able to take that home and kind of feel confident about what they're purchasing. So they're not just getting a souvenir bottle, but it's one that they'll have a memory from the tasting from.
So there was a time that you could go on the tour and you couldn't take home a souvenir, but as, as any of the product?
Correct. We were not allowed to sample product on tour. So at the end of the tour, a lot of people were often kind of disappointed when we served them lemonade.
Oh, that's what you would serve them?
Some people started calling that yellow label.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So yeah, we would at the end of the tour just to kind of, because it can be a little bit hot. And it takes about an hour and 15 minutes to take the tour. But we actually are walking you through our facility. It's a fully functioning distillery. So, you know, the areas that, you know, the stills are driven by steam, so they can be kind of warm. So there's areas where when people get to the end of the tour, often they're ready for something to drink. So we still serve lemonade today.
Still to this day.
We still do. But now we're able to do these sampling tours, but also have a bottle shop where people can take product home, which is really nice.
Well, you've been making a whiskey in Lynchburg for over 100 years.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a modern plant and with, you know, all the things. But is there parts of the plant that are like, you know, decades old?
Yeah. If you look at our facility, of course, we started there back in 1866. We were shut down through state and national prohibition. We were able to start back up in the 1930s. So the distillery that you see when you're on tour there was built in the late 1930s. The oldest of our warehouses also built in that same era. But we're on the National Register of Historic Places. So we do our very best to try to maintain the look and feel of the distillery and kind of being unchanged over time. So very much going back in time. When you walk through there, and it's a very pastoral setting. I think the distillery, I've been there 16 years, but I still get taken aback at times just driving into work in the mornings. Yeah. And what a beautiful place it is, and the cave spring, and, you know, we've got wild turkeys running everywhere, ducks running on the property. They, you know, when grain gets unloaded, some of it is always going to spill on the ground. They kind of come in and clean it up. For us, so, you know, these are like grain-fed ducks and grain-fed turkeys running all over the property. But, you know, I think the beauty of the distillery is really unsurpassed. It's a special place for a lot of reasons, but I love coming to work every morning.
Well, and God bless you. You know what? As my grandfather always said, if you love coming to work, then you've got it made in life. Well, now, one of the interesting things, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on our podcast is, you know, a lot of people make a pilgrimage up to Lynchburg. But now the state of Tennessee has actually expanded on that experience. And I want you to tell everybody what's going on here, because it's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. You know, Jack Daniel's has been giving tours now for over 50 years, and that seems to have grown year over year. And we're usually somewhere between 250 and 300,000 people who make the trek to Lynchburg and tour the distillery each year. But just looking at what's been going on in Kentucky with the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, where they started collectively marketing themselves as an experience, as sort of a, you know, a bachelor party, a bachelorette party, a guy's weekend, whatever you might want to do. But come to Kentucky and kind of, as a group of friends, go around and you can sample whiskeys and tour all the different distilleries. And it has more than doubled the amount of tourism that they saw up in Kentucky. So, you know, as many people as we already have coming to Lynchburg, we see that, you know, a Tennessee whiskey trail might potentially, you know, double and or triple the amount of traffic we see to Lynchburg. And we would love, we see people from all over the world who come to Lynchburg. You know, we love to see people returning back. A lot of people have taken the tour before, come every year. You know, others may only come one time in their life, but, you know, no matter what brings them there, we just want them to have a great time. But now, just a few years ago, there were three distilleries in the state of Tennessee. All of them gave tours of different types, but now we have over 30 distilleries.
Different sizes, I imagine.
And making all different types of products. You know, not everybody's making Tennessee whiskey, even though that's what we're best known for. You have people who make gin and vodka and different forms of distilled spirits. But literally all the way from Memphis, Tennessee to Bristol, you know, right up on the Virginia border, we have distilleries that run from one end of the state to the other. So we have worked on a mobile app, a website, a travel planner. We've got passports. We're going to launch later this month. We're going to hold an event in Franklin, which is just south of Nashville. And basically announced to the world that we have an official Tennessee whiskey trail and how to access all of the collateral goods that go along with that. We'll have stamps for their passport. The first people who, of course, make it to all the distilleries are going to get special hats and shirts and stuff that for having been the first to make it through.
All right, got a goal.
So we're gonna challenge people who, you know, have the time on their hands and can spend a week with us to try to visit all the distilleries that are part of the trail. But we're really excited about it, you know, in this official. We started a Tennessee Distillers Guild a few years ago as new people started coming in. One of the great things about our industry is that we are largely a gentleman's industry. We really don't try to compete with each other as much as we try to make our products grow together. We want to make, as a group, we'd like to make whiskey interesting and be attractive to beer drinkers and vodka drinkers so that we say a rising tide will raise all ships.
Yeah, that's
and
a great
attitude to have. That's sort of the philosophy that we have, that we want to work collectively to have different products, but interesting products that make everyone a whiskey drinker.
Well, that's cool that you do that, because obviously you guys got to be the big dog.
We are. We're the big lure on the line, I call it. But but at the same time, I think we have a lot to benefit from this, because if you were to talk to the people who come, like I said, 250 to 300,000 people are coming to Lynchburg. If you were to ask them, you know, why did you come here? Many of them didn't come to Tennessee just for the distillery tour.
Yeah.
They just found themselves passing through and then found that it was close enough that they could make it a side trip. But when you it's quite different in Kentucky. If you talk to the people who are at the bourbon distilleries, 70 or 80% of them have come to Kentucky expressly just to tour the distillery. So that was the main attraction. It was the lure that got them to come to town. So we have talked with the state of Tennessee, the departments of tourism, ECD, the people who are interested in rural development, because a lot of our distilleries operate outside of city centers and out in the outskirts of the state, you know, that we can improve tourism, business, offer jobs and stuff like that. So they've been partnering with us to try to get this launched, because they see that this is a good thing for the state of Tennessee. And we're all very excited to be a part of its launch. I think we'll all look back and say, I remember when we launched the Tennessee Whiskey Trail, and hopefully it becomes a big deal.
Okay, and let me just shout out the greatness of the state of Tennessee, which is one of the most beautiful states to drive through. It's a beautiful state. And then Nashville, right in the middle, is the home of country music, and people obviously know that I'm very associated with that industry.
Yep.
And I did not know this until I was in Nashville a few weeks ago, but Nashville has become the bachelorette capital of the world.
It is. If you go downtown, these things have become very popular, and it's called Pedal Taverns.
Yes. Yeah, we have a couple here. I've seen those,
But you will see, you know, 8 to 10 young ladies, and obviously one of which is a bride, wearing something on her head to kind of identify her. But they'll all have on matching shirts that have funny slogans
sashes,
on them.
Yeah.
Yep, and they're peddling these taverns around downtown and kind of drinking and singing along. And but it's Nashville. If you haven't been in Nashville in a few years, it is a great town.
Yeah.
It has gotten a little bit expensive from a hotel standpoint, so you need to book early and maybe try to stay away from weekends where you have big music festivals and stuff like that. But it's a wonderful town to visit on any weekend. And always lots of live music.
And so just to make your whole Tennessee experience great, if you're gonna do the Tennessee Whiskey Trail, make a stop in Nashville. I highly recommend it, because the main street, the Broad Street, right through the middle of the town, Broadway. They have numerous venues, like bars, and they always have live music in there. And some of these bars, there's one owned by Dirk Bentley, one owned by Florida Georgia Line. Alan Jackson has one. Yep. And then there's ones that have been there for decades.
Yeah,
like
you've got Tootsie's and The Stage.
Yeah.
Who, you know, and if you go into Tootsie's, you never know who's going to show up.
You know who was there? You know who was at Tootsie's last time I was in there?
Who's that?
John Fogerty and Brad Paisley together. Now, how often does that happen?
Yeah. And it wasn't that long ago that Cher walked in. They have a special booth that they have sort of a velvet rope that kind of guards, where they can use security and kind of hold people off of celebrities who come and just want to listen to the music. But I think actually she caused such a stir that she had to leave. There were so many people who wanted like selfies with her, wanted to talk to her and everything, that I don't think she realized what a fanship she had in Nashville until she came to Tootsie's.
And Tootsie's, for those who aren't familiar with it, there's an alley between the back of Tootsie's and the Ryman Auditorium where the Grand Ole Opry used to be. Yep. So after the Grand Ole Opry, everybody would just go out the back door into Tootsie's across the alley.
Yep. It's two levels. It's two levels. So you have a backstage that's sort of on an upper level. Then you have the main stage that kind of faces down on Broadway. But they've got live music going on both ends of the place. And it's always crazy in there, but it's a great time.
Up and down the street. Yeah, it's just amazing down there. Okay, now I'm going to ask, now we're going to get back to whiskey here, because I'm going to ask some questions, because I'm not going to have the master distiller of Jack Daniel's here without getting clarification on different distinctions of whiskey. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. So first of all, to be Tennessee whiskey just doesn't mean you're in the state border of Tennessee.
No,
it's got to be made a special way.
It takes more than that. Uh-huh. You know, I think a lot of people think that if you make a whiskey in Kentucky, that it's automatically a bourbon.
Uh-huh. But that's my next question.
Yeah, but it's not. You know, you can make bourbon in any U.S. state. It is a product of America. Distinctly, it has to be 51% corn. It doesn't necessarily have to come from Kentucky, but if you put the words Kentucky bourbon
then
on your label, then it has to come from Kentucky.
Okay.
But you know, whiskey's it's a global term. It can be made on any country on the planet. It just means that you take grain, you ferment it, you distill it, and then you mature it in a barrel. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the basic process statement that ties together Tennessee whiskey with bourbon, mm-hmm. with Canadian whiskeys, with Scotch whiskeys. That's kind of what we all do. We mm-hmm. ferment grain, we distill it, and we put it in barrels to mature it. But if you call yourself bourbon, you have to first be a product of America. You have to be 51% corn on your grain bill. You have to distill below 160 proof, mm-hmm. Where globally whiskeys begin around 189. And the lower you distill, the more character you have. So this was intentional on America's part that they wanted bourbon whiskeys, American whiskeys, to have a little bit more character.
Mm-hmm. When you say they, who is they?
The people who were writing the federal codes that define all the different types of spirits.
Okay, so this actual federal codes.
There are federal codes.
Federal trade codes?
Yes, the code of federal regulations has a whole section dedicated just to our industry.
Okay.
And it defines what gin is, what vodka is, what class two whiskeys are, what bourbons
Washington
are.
And Jefferson in on this? I mean, how far back is it?
I'm not sure it goes all the way back that far.
But it's more of through the federal trade commission.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff was written after Prohibition when they were allowing people to distill again. They created process statements and definition that defined certain products and how they had to be made.
Okay.
But the biggest difference in bourbon whiskey and all the other whiskeys of the world is that you can't reuse barrels and call yourself bourbon. You have to be in a new charred oak barrel.
Oh.
You're prohibited from using colorings or flavoring, so they have to be all natural as well.
Uh-huh.
You have restrictions on your entry proof into the barrel and also your bottle proof. If you're in the barrel less than 4 years, you have to use age statement. So it drives a lot of honesty and transparency.
Uh-huh.
I think it for bourbon whiskeys and American whiskeys, and I'll often tell people I think there's great bourbons and maybe some not so great bourbons, but at least they're all natural and they're all honest in how they're being produced. Now, Tennessee, was basically beginning to distill around the same time as Kentucky. Kentucky was largely, becoming famous for bourbon. They were right in the heart of corn country and everything. Yeah. So there was a regional variant, I call it, of bourbon that came out of the area where we are. We're in Moore County, but originally the distillery was in Lincoln County when there were fewer counties in the state. So this thing called the Lincoln County process started to develop, and it was where people were taking whiskey from their stills and they were slowly dripping it through hard sugar maple charcoal.
Okay.
And what they were finding is that, the spirit, when it comes off the stills, can... being high in corn would tell you that it's going to be sweet because that's the nature of corn.
Yeah.
But corn has a tendency to cover its own sweetness up with a lot of bitter elements.
Uh-huh.
That's what the barrel's designed to address, is to soften the bitter edge using the barrel as a way of doing that. But what people like Jack Daniel and Charles Nelson and George Dickel from the Cascade Hollow Distillery, what they were learning is that hard sugar maple charcoal was even more effective and efficient at doing it. You need to spend days to mellow it. But it gives you a head start, kind of getting into the barrel.
Okay.
So if you take a bourbon and you put it through charcoal mellowing before you put it in a barrel, then you become a Tennessee whiskey.
I see. And there's an extra step.
There's no exceptions. There's just one additional step.
Uh-huh.
But it's that step that kind of defines Tennessee whiskey as being something different than bourbon.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then Scotch is that it can only be made in Scotland, or is there
correct
that it can only be made in Scotland?
Yep. An Irish whiskey can only be made in Ireland.
Okay.
A Scotch whiskey can only be made in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
If you look at Japanese whiskeys today, in every regard, they're just like Scotch.
Yeah.
But they're made in Japan.
Okay.
They follow very similar production tenets, production processes, forms of flavor, the way they source their flavors, and even using like smoke and peat potentially. Uh-huh. They're very much just saying, we think we can do a whiskey as good as the people from Scotland, but we can do it in our own country. So, and Japanese whiskeys have done very well over the last few years, developing a reputation for themselves. But right now, American whiskey is hot, especially some of the small craft brands that are kind of showing some innovation and some range of flavors. Irish whiskeys are definitely big. We are a whiskey company, and we're kind of increasing our breadth. We're opening up an Irish whiskey brand. We've just purchased three single malt Scotch brands,
and those will be produced in Scotland and Ireland.
Absolutely.
Wow.
We've largely been an American whiskey company. Our founding brand was Old Forester, out of Kentucky. Jack Daniel's, of course, is sort of the standard bearer of Tennessee whiskey, if you will. But we do consider ourselves to be the American whiskey company because that's largely what our portfolio consists of.
Well, Jeff Arnett, master distiller, only the seventh.
only the seventh.
In the history of Jack Daniel's going back. And the very first was Jack Daniel's himself?
Jasper Newton Daniel. Jack was his nickname.
Yeah,
but he was the founder and since 1866.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to have links on my Travel with Hawkeye blog on the Tennessee Whiskey Trail.
Yeah.
and also tours of the distillery there.
Yes.
And thank you very much. And I totally enjoyed our conversation. And, usually I get people on the phone, so the fact that you came in the studio, I really appreciate that, too.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Jeff Arnett, master distiller at Jack Daniel's. Well, we shift focus now to an Olympic athlete. Joining us on the phone is Simone Biles. Simone, of course, an Olympic medalist, 4 gold medals and a bronze at the Rio Games. She's got a brand new book called Courage to Soar. And Simone, is it safe to say I'm the first person named Hawkeye who's ever interviewed you?
Yes, most definitely.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you because, first of all, I just want to thank you for all the excitement. I'm a huge fan of the Olympics, and my wife just teases me how much time I spend in front of the TV during the Olympics. And I had it was just so much fun to watch you compete, you and the Final Five, and just thank you for that because as an American, you know, there's a lot of hometown pride, but I just enjoyed so much watching you compete in the Rio Games.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you a question. When you said you were the Final Five, and that, of course, had a lot to do with your coach and everything. You were the last five. Do you think that that the American gymnastic team the next in 4 years from now, do you think they'll be as competitive as you guys have been in the last Olympics?
I think so. I think, in a way, you feel a little bit pressure from the past team to carry that legacy on and do just as good. So it is a little bit stressful, but I have no doubt they'll do a good job, whoever that may be.
Well, you have a new book called Courage to Soar, and in it you talk about your life. And one of the more interesting things, and it's a great lesson here, you talk about something that happened in 2011 at the National Championships in St. Paul and how you missed out making the U.S. National Junior Team by one spot. But you used that as kind of a springboard to future success, did you not?
No, I did. And I think kids reading that and seeing the failure, I feel like they can almost do the same. So it's just to never give up. And it's a reminder that I'm normal too. So you can always bounce back and you are the leader of your life. So it's a good message.
It is a great message. I think it's a wonderful message because, you know, so often in life you have setbacks, but, you know, one door closes, another door is open, another door opens, or sometimes the door closes. But like in your case here, you use that as inspiration, and it took you to heights that were just almost unimaginable. I mean, 4 Olympic gold medals, that's never been done before by a U.S. gymnast.
I mean, it's just crazy to think about, but I'm, like, excited and happy that I could be the one to do that. Because never in a million dreams do you ever think that the possibility is going to happen because there's so many athletes training for the same thing that you are, but you always have hope for yourself and you believe in yourself. But then to come out with the medals that I did, I was shocked.
It was unbelievable watching you in the Rio Games because it kind of looked like you had taken this sport to a whole another level. I mean, that's how I felt when I was watching you.
Oh, thank you.
Let me ask you a question about how you got started, because I read this. It's in your book, Courage to Soar. And correct me if I've got this wrong, but you kind of got started because you went to a field trip to a gymnastics studio and one of the coaches saw your natural ability. Is that how it kind of all started?
Yes, that's exactly how it started. It was kind of an accident, and they're walking to the front. They spotted me, this little girl, buff, and then they sent a letter home.
And they send your letter home, say that this girl looks like she has some natural ability and that you should really get her into your gym. At that point, were you living with your grandparents when this all happened?
Yeah, I was in Texas living with my parents, yes.
And so, okay, so at that point, when they got the letter home, did they think, oh, this is just a scam to sign up our daughter for an after-school activity? Or did they also think, wow, you know what, we've kind of thought the same thing too, we should really pursue this?
I think they just thought I had a lot of energy, and if there was something that I would fall in love with and it would project that energy into a good environment, then they were completely okay with it because they saw me flipping around the house too. So my mom just wanted me to do it somewhere safe, so it was a perfect opportunity.
Yes, why don't you stay away from the coffee table, I guess. What is the next step in the life of Simone Biles? What's coming up next for you?
Oh, gosh, vacation. I'm so excited.
Where is Simone Biles going on vacation? And you don't have to give details, you know, we don't want to know your resort or wherever you're going, but what do you want to see? What do you want to do? What do you want to visit?
I want to go on the beach. I want to relax, hopefully learn to either paddleboard or surf, go cliff diving, maybe even parasailing. But I'm going to Belize and then Hawaii.
Oh, wow. Okay, so we're starting in Belize, formerly known as the British Honduras, going there, which is a great place to windsurf, great place to paddleboard, great beaches. What made you choose Belize?
My mom's actually from Belize, so all of us have dual citizenship, and that's like our safe place that we love to call our second home. So we go there at least, we try once a year, every summer, just to get away.
Oh, I did not know that. I love Belize. It's a beautiful, beautiful country. Okay, then Hawaii. Is there a specific island? First of all, have you visited Hawaii before?
Yes, I've been twice. The first time was Oahu, and then the second time we took a cruise around all the islands, and I think we're going to be at Oahu this time.
Okay, so, yeah, you know, people always ask me, because I went to high school in Hawaii, they always say, what island should I go to? And I always say, well, what do you expect from your Hawaiian vacation? So you like the beaches, do you like a little bit of the nightlife? Do you like that aspect of Hawaii?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, all right, Oahu would be perfect for you. Well, you know, let me ask you this also about your career in gymnastics when it comes to traveling. And I always wonder this, when someone gets to go to the Olympics, do you have enough free time to see any other events, or do you have enough free time to see any of the country, or is it just practice and compete, practice and compete?
Practice, compete, practice, compete. And then after, once you get your job done, because initially you're going there for a job.
Yeah.
Once you get that done, then sometimes you have a day off. We were thankful to have one, but it was hard because we still had a media day, and then it's like, go home time because you've been there for so long, and after we did what we did, we couldn't really go anywhere without any security, so it's kind of hard.
Oh, I could definitely imagine, yeah, because, you know, not only you started out with the team all around, and then there was the individual all around, and then there was each apparatus event, so really, if you're a gymnast like yourself, your schedule is very packed during the whole Olympics, is it not?
Yes, it is. We're always training or always resting.
Since you didn't get to see a lot of Brazil, would that maybe be on Simone Biles' bucket list later?
Oh, I definitely want to go back in a couple of years. Yeah, I would love that.
Fantastic. Well, Simone, it was a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Continued success. I can't wait to see what's in the next chapter, but well-deserved vacation coming up. And congratulations on the new book, Courage to Soar.
Thank you so much.
And as always, if later you decide to buy the book and if we'll find out more about Simone, you're like, I can't remember the name of it, you can always go back to www.travelwithhawkeye.net. Go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net, click on blog, and just find the blog post for this podcast with Simone Biles, and I'll have links to her book and all sorts of information on the Tennessee Whiskey Trail also. Special thanks to Jeff Arnett, master distiller at Jack Daniel's, only the seventh ever, and to Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles for being our guest on Travel with Hawkeye. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. This has been the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. Remember, your adventure awaits.